This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, That's Not Equality, when sexism dresses up as feminism in speculative fiction, part two.
So, yeah, we were a little bit ambitious last week in our subject.
Yeah, I usually think, ooh, we haven't got enough material. This time I thought we might have a bit too much material, and we had way too much material.
Way too much material. We were sort of approaching the hour-long mark, and we were like, oh no, we've barely started.
That's at least another hour. So if you haven't listened to part one, you might want to do that first. Just a quick reminder, this is going to be super spoilery, so any book or film we talk about, we will spoilify you. Just so that you're aware. And we've discussed what, you know, we're talking about in terms of feminism, etc. We're not going to rehash that again now because we would actually like to get through all the other points we were going to discuss.
And remember, this episode and the books that we talk about and the films and stuff, these are not a judgment on your taste. If you love these books, great. We are not saying you're not allowed to, and we're not saying you're not allowed to have taken something out of it. No problem with that at all. With that, let's get back into the topic at hand. And I think the best place that we can probably start is that a woman's worth is her ability to reproduce.
Yeah, this is absolutely one of my top bugbears. They're all my bugbears, but this is very much a bugbear in fantasy. And that is when
this is the king bugbear. This is the boss bugbear. If you're fighting all the bugbears, this is the bugbear that Jules faces at the end.
There's two or three. They sort of vie for the top spot. But anyway, basically, a female character's value is reduced to her reproductive capacity. I really hope I don't have to explain why, if you have any story where the female lead is the mother of the great savior or the next great king or whatever, and that's what she does, why that is really, really sexist before you do anything else with it. It's not that it's impossible, but if you go down that line and your female main character, her role is to give birth to the next great leader who probably is going to be male, then you're going to have your work cut out for you in making that a non-misogynistic story.
Yes. Now, it is absolutely still 100% possible to have a mother character and for her to still be a fully formed character and to even tell the story of someone who's meant to be the mother of, you know, a dynasty or something like that. Something that comes to mind is Dany. Dany, who was the mother of Perseus, I believe it was. I've actually read some really interesting things which basically say, because Perseus obviously gets a lot of the attention, I've read some really interesting stories which look at Dany's story, what she went through, where she was the main character. So we're not saying you can't have that narrative. We're saying that depending how you frame it, you are probably going to struggle to make this a feminist text. And remember, when we're talking about feminist, we're not saying it's all about women, we're saying that it's equal. And that is ultimately the difficulty is not to say that it's unfeminist to want to have a child. It's to create this link between being a woman is 100% tied with your reproductive organs.
Absolutely. It's problematic for so many different reasons, not least, obviously, if you have trans women who are reading the books as well. That's also really, really offensive to say that, you know, you're somehow less of a woman if you haven't got a womb. You know, you weren't born with one. Same with for women who are reading books. Who just don't want to have children, or, you know, for some reason they've been ill or they've lost their uterus, to suggest that because they do not have an ordinary reproductive system that somehow they're lesser. So that's already really problematic. I think the other thing for me that's an issue is that a lot of people put a mother character in, and then it's kind of like the whole romance thing where the female lead becomes the love interest. But in this respect, all her personality bleeds out of her and she becomes nothing more than sort of a mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen it done well, actually, in the sense of Seanan Maguire's October Day series, where October, as a changeling, has a child in changeling terms quite young, but in fae terms it's quite young, but actually she's around about 50 in human years. She just looks about 22. And, you know, she has a very complicated, and it goes into exploring the very complicated dynamics of being something that is more long-lived than your own children, and the whole idea of abandonment issues and things like that, and the way October's own mother sort of abandoned her and treated her kind of like a toy. And it was really well done, and October herself is kind of, you know, she's a bit of a lioness as well. So you absolutely can do it. I think when it's a case of your female character's claim to fame is she's going to give birth to the next king, that's a double whammy of sexism, because it's kind of like, well, you're not even giving birth to the next monarch. It's like, no, it's very specifically a male one. So, yeah, there's lots of issues there for me. And... you know, we're picking on Sarah J. Maas a lot, but she really has done some absolute perler examples in her most recent book. Let's unpack what happens in A Court of Silver Flames in terms of reproduction, because this is not good.
So one of the things I think it's worth noting is that in A Court of Mist and Fury, Feyre said at one point she would like to have children, but she says, I actually kind of want some time just between us first.
Which is perfectly logical.
Perfectly logical, yeah. And Rhysand was like, yeah, don't worry, we've got hundreds of years. We're absolutely fine. We're not in a rush. And then in A Court of Frost and Starlight, which is around the time that Sarah J. Maas then also became pregnant, Feyre. Whoops.
Let's be honest here. We all know.
Feyre suddenly went, no, I want to have a child now, which seemed to really be a response to the trauma that obviously they'd been through, which, okay, fine, but at the same time didn't seem like a particularly healthy response. So they say, right, we're going to have a child. And big spoiler, guys, we get to A Court of Silver Flames, and apparently, despite the fact that having children is incredibly hard in this particular world, to the extent that it can take years and years and years, Feyre is insta-pregnant. She's there, she's pregnant, she's ready to have a baby. Now, here's where things get seriously messy. Because first of all, they had to find a very convenient way to depower Feyre. So suddenly it's not just, right, I'm not going to go into battle because I'm pregnant, which, again, I can sort of understand. It's, no, I can't even use basic kinds of magic. I can only use a very, very loose type of magic because I'm pregnant, and using magic is somehow supposed to be bad for the baby.
Yeah, so I can kind of get the whole perhaps you shouldn't shapeshift thing.
Yeah.
Maybe. Although if an embryo is adapted for your body, then really it should be able to cope in the first trimester at least. Admittedly, the Fae have slightly different, 11 months they're pregnant for? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's a bit shabby world building wise, but you're not supposed to do anything else. They've kind of said, hey, Feyre, you've got mystical preeclampsia and therefore you should stay off your feet for this entire book.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then...
Okay, all right, so let's unpack this. This is something which genuinely, it didn't just disappoint me, it really upset me.
It was offensive. It was incredibly offensive.
Which is that what happens is Feyre is pregnant, And you find out that because she and Rhysand did the do while she was shifted as an Illyrian, so with her wings, which means that she probably got pregnant at some point in a court of stars and a court of sex and shopping. That one, the yes. silver, whatever, I can't remember what it's called. Frost and Starlight. So, okay, we'll put that to the side for now. So she's about to give birth to a baby which has wings. Now this is a problem because she's shifted back, she's pregnant, she's got this baby inside of her that has wings, and she now doesn't have the anatomy in order to give birth to a child with wings. All right, fine.
Yes, so apparently hyphae pelvises are the wrong shape.
Are the wrong shape. Which, again, I can kind of understand it. I can kind of understand that, yeah, you probably need to have a certain pelvis shape in order to give birth to something which has wings, which aren't very bendable. So, fine. Now, what happens is that they say, no, transforming will be a risk to you, to the child. If you transform now, it would be a risk to the child. So no transforming. So she goes, okay, all right. Even though that would be the most convenient thing would be for her just to transform into an Illyrian and then just hold it like that. But perhaps the argument could be, okay, but I can only transform for short periods of time. You could still transform just before you gave birth. It probably wouldn't really matter that much. Regardless.
Yes.
What happens is that Rhysand tells Feyre that the birth is going to be incredibly difficult. And she goes, all right, fine. She's kind of ready for this. This is a woman who's already been through some incredible difficulties. She's probably like, yeah, I really want this child. I really love my husband. I'm willing to go through some pain to bring this child into the world.
I don't think he actually does tell her it's going to be incredibly difficult. He said he says
it's going to be, it's likely to be a difficult birth. So he tells her that. What he doesn't tell her is that actually it's not just that it's likely to be a difficult birth. This is a birth that is incredibly likely to kill both her and the child. In fact, there's been almost no examples where a fae of any kind who's gotten pregnant by an Illyrian and has given birth to a winged child has survived, or the child has survived. Rhysand decides not to tell Feyre this, despite the fact she's quite early on in her pregnancy. He says, let's not tell her this. I don't want to worry her. I don't want to take away the joy she's feeling at being pregnant. It's a very flat excuse. And he tells everybody else in the inner circle, but swears them to secrecy. And of course, when Rhysand swears someone to secrecy, you kind of have to obey because he's the High Lord, as shown by the fact that he's kind of very domineering, etc. So no one else can tell Feyre about this. Rhysand is running around, getting steadily more desperate, going to other courts so that they find out about how they can possibly give birth to this child without Feyre and the child dying. Then what happens is that Nesta actually spills the beans to Feyre several months down the line. She gets angry and she says, you do realise they're keeping secrets from you. And Nesta is the one who's framed as being the bad guy here. Like, she did the wrong thing. Now, not only does this piss me off royally, it also takes into account that there has never, at any point, even with Rhysand, even with Feyre, where they've sat down and had a conversation which says, the embryo in your body right now is likely to die and also to kill you. So even though we want a child, shall we have a very candid conversation about an abortion? Now you could say, oh, but they wouldn't have abortion. Bollocks. You know they must have abortion because they have a potion which actually works as a contraceptive. Which means if you have that potion which works as a contraceptive, you have potion which can then induce a miscarriage of some kind, usually because that there would have been a link between those two kinds of medicinal kinds of things. Okay, so it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that they wouldn't even have that kind of technology. It also doesn't make sense that they can give people like a mechanical bloody eye, that someone can have their guts literally ripped out of their body and then be back onto the battlefield without a scar the next day. But apparently a cesarean section is just, oh no, too much. Ridiculous. Yeah. Okay, so we're putting all of that aside. Putting all of that aside, you still, at no point, had Rhysand turn to Feyre and say, let's have a serious conversation about an abortion. He didn't give her that choice. And yet Nesta, for being the one who turns around and says, no, I don't think this is... And for telling Feyre, regardless of her reasons for telling Feyre, to be painted as the bad guy, to be painted as someone who's hurting Feyre, is mind-boggling. And I will say this right now. In book two, Tamlin is seen as being really evil and abusive because he traps Feyre in his mansion. He's doing that because there are people who are likely trying to literally kill Feyre or capture her or steal her magic back, and he is reacting to trauma. Now, I'm not saying what he did was right. I'm saying that I can understand his reasons for doing it. Rhysand's reasons for not telling his wife, and apparently the woman he loves most in the world, that she is literally dying because of the embryo in her body, is that she's happy now and I don't want to take away any of the joy. That is absolute bollocks. It's all about him, it's all about the fact that he's uncomfortable with this conversation, and there is this massive undercurrent that he doesn't actually, regardless of whether Mass intended this or not, there is an undercurrent which is that he doesn't want to give Feyre the option to have an abortion until she finds out much later on, at which point it is too late.
Yeah. I'd even go further than that and say that even if you've been trying to conceive a child, and you find you're pregnant, at some point you need to have the conversation about whether it's something you still both want, whether you want to go through with that pregnancy, whether you are actually ready right now. Because sometimes actually finding you're pregnant can actually make you think, actually, this is not something I want to do right now. And there's no mm-hmm. shame in that. There's nothing wrong with it. You should absolutely be able to have all your options on the table, which include not having the baby. Would like to point out that for all the shit Stephanie Meyer gets, one of the things that is very definitely discussed, admittedly off page by Bella and Edward, is, and by the, all the Cullens, is Bella not having the child, not having yeah. Renesmee. And Bella's the one who's saying, no, I'm going to go through with it. I think I can stay, I can keep holding on to the end and then emergency vampirization, which is perhaps not the best call, but you know what, it is her choice. But everybody else is kind of like, no, this is going to kill you. This is bad. We should do something about this. This is not something that Mass ever touches on, even once. And I can't help feeling that there is a distinct white Anglo-Saxon Protestant morality behind it as well. Maybe there isn't, but it feels like there is. As in, this is not a topic we can even touch upon. And when you yes. reduce women to being at the mercy of their bodies, which, you know, newsflash people, but we've had abortifacients since we lived in the caves. They weren't always effective, in the same way that the contraceptives we had back when we were living in caves weren't always effective. They were still effective about 80% of the time. So we've never been completely at the mercy of our own reproductive systems the way that certain periods of history would like us to believe. So this is absolutely just bollocks to then put something like this in a fantasy novel where they can shapeshift and do all sorts of magical things, and yet somehow they can't have an aseptic condition for a cesarean section. That's just ridiculous.
Yes, it is. It's incredibly angering. And it was done in order to create drama. Now, frankly, what would have worked better, much better for me, would have been if they didn't realise that the baby had wings until it was time for the birth.
Yeah.
That could have erased all of it, because what could have happened at that point is that they could say, we have to do a cesarean section, but she's already lost a significant amount of blood because this baby is premature and because something has gone wrong. Now, something happening in the moment because people are unprepared for it, that makes sense. There's a great risk there. I could believe that Feyre might die at that point because of something unforeseen. The fact that they knew is the bit that really annoys me. In fact, it doesn't just annoy me, it genuinely upsets me. And for this novel, which is being put forward as being all kind of like high feminist, and obviously sex is at the forefront of this novel. It really is. In fact, it's shoved in places that it probably shouldn't be. It's shoved in there are sex scenes, there are sexy thoughts, which just feel so unnatural in lots of places. And then even the main three female characters, you know, Nesta, Gwyn, and... I've forgotten what her name is.
Emery,
that's it. They're all exchanging romance novels, so there's literally sex everywhere, and they're all thinking about it constantly. It beggars belief that they have this whole narrative about sex, and at no point do they then, and sex and then pregnancy, but only pregnancy once married, I should point out, also. Pregnancy once mated. They have this whole bloody narrative. And at no point is the other side of that narrative even mentioned. At no point did they say, okay, but what about unwanted pregnancies? Because no, absolutely no contraceptive is infallible. And if it was, in this fey world, if they could definitely stop someone from getting pregnant, that means they could definitely, definitely terminate a pregnancy or deliver a baby safely through cesarean section. I'm going to stop now because I'm actually getting upset.
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredibly offensive thing to put in there. At best, it's really shit, lazy world building. At worst, some of what she genuinely thinks crept in there. I'd like to think it's more the former than the latter, but you never know. And it's the way it's... In fact, well, let's go on to the next point, because the next point touches on how it is actually handled when you get onto the end. So again, super spoilery for this next book, but... our next point is the female lead is never allowed to be more powerful than the male lead, or in fact, in this case, any man in the book at all. And that's even in her own story. And this is never more apparent than Nesta. Nesta, who was forced into the cauldron against her will, forced to become High Fae against her will. Let's remember how much Nesta hated the Fae. And so she forced the cauldron to give up more of its power than it wanted to give her. And... Yeah. She sort of becomes almost a quasi-death goddess through the powers that she gets, although it's never really explored. But it's enough that it puts the shits up Rhysand, who is supposed to be the most powerful High Lord that a Night Court has ever had, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's enough to make him think, oh God, I would struggle to fight against her, they never tell her this. They keep things about her power, her own power, that she legitimately probably needs to know from her. They don't tell her things. And I don't care how difficult she is. If you've got someone who is walking around and they're literally basically a walking nuclear bomb, but they could learn to control it, then you keep trying to teach them how to control it, even if they are rude to you. That's it's just stupid not to do that and say, oh, well, I'm offended by the way you talk to me. Particularly from a being that was like 6,000 years old. It's like, really? Those petty barbs offended you? Come on.
Yeah, calm down. Calm down.
So it's just... That was really stupid. Skipping over the things that she does actually manage to accomplish with her power. You get to the end, Feyre is giving birth. Guess what? She's dying. And because of that stupid vow she's made with Rhysand will die when Feyre dies as well. So, you know, they're really working on destabilising their kingdom by removing the monarchs.
Yeah.
And Nesta makes a deal with the cauldron to give up everything that she took from it in return for Feyre being saved, being brought back, basically. and having her pelvis reshaped so that she can give birth to Illyrian babies. And she has some refurbishment done to her own anatomy too, because, you know, she might want babies too. And it's just... that's, once again, you've got someone who is really interestingly powered in a way that it becomes their greatest weakness as well as their greatest strength. It's never really explored, and then she gives it all up for reproductive rights. And it's like, oh, fuck off, seriously.
Yeah. Now, as Jules has pointed out, Jules, you actually kind of like the whole having to give up, having to sacrifice your powers narrative.
If it's done right, yes. And I'm, you know, I've flirted with it with my own writing, so I'm not going to be like pot kettle black on this one, but...
No, absolutely. And I completely agree. It can be a really interesting narrative choice. The thing that gets me is that they hint towards Nesta's power. They say it's like pure death, etc. What the fuck does that mean? Sorry for swearing, but what does it mean? We get to see her do one cool thing where she performs a little bit of necromancy, and I was like, hell yeah! Let's have a narrative where Nesta is a necromancer. Let's have a narrative where she goes off and starts her own court. You know, where's the Dusk Court? There's no Dusk Court. Let there be a Dusk Court. She'll start it. I was thinking, oh, maybe we'll have a whole new setup of a new court, and she will be the high fair, you know, the high lord of that, the first real high lady, you know, who grabbed power onto her own. I thought that would have been so cool, but no, that doesn't happen. She has this power. We see her using one of the, whatever, the troves or whatever. We do see her using a few of them. And then that's it. We never actually find out what her actual power is. Apparently she does still retain some of it, so maybe we will see some of that later on. But it really, really, really annoys me, because there was so much potential there, and then it was just gone like that. And apparently she also had the power to change Feyre's pelvis when no one else did. Understand. And apparently also it was fine if she changed Feyre's pelvis, but not okay if Feyre herself changed her pelvis. I don't understand.
You're talking about Feyre, but you've based their biology on human biology, and apparently you don't understand human biology or pregnancy despite having had a child. And it's just, no, come on. It doesn't work. I mean, I have to say, there's a book called Witch's Honour, which is the third book in the trilogy by Jan Segel, which is the Prospero's Children series. And I've mentioned it before, but the idea is that you have certain people who have an Atlantean gift, and it can miss generations and generations and then throw true in one person kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Fern, you start off in the first book, she's 16 and, you know, finds out she's got this power. By the third book, she's sort of in her late 20s to early 30s, I think. And, you know, she's become quite accomplished with it. And she is struggling because she's getting to the point where she realises that it has impacted her life. She's not just a marketing executive. This is something that it tempts her constantly. And she's not necessarily going to have a normal human life. And even so, she's still kind of okay with it, right up until the point where she ends up killing somebody to defend herself. And she realises that, yeah, even though she had a perfectly good reason for killing this person, someone who she just slept with as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was sort of a double trauma there. As in, thought I liked you, turns out you were working for the enemy all the time and I was being manipulated, I'm not okay. And she understands that she's not... she chooses service, basically. She chooses a human life in which she can enrich the lives of people around her over having this power, which will isolate her and may mean that she'll live for hundreds of years, but she won't really be human anymore. And I remember reading it at sort of 19 and thinking, well, that's a bit of a swizz, isn't it? But reading it again as I've got older, I'm like, okay, I still might not have gone with that choice, but I understand why you made it and it does make sense.
Yes.
I don't feel the same care and attention was given in A Court of Silver Flames.
No, absolutely. And again, it was actually just small changes, small things, which caused it to be framed in an uncomfortable way, I think. If there had been small changes, it wouldn't have jarred nearly as much.
No, definitely. Okay, our next point, and, you know, again, with picking on Sarah J Maas, but it's not just her, slut-shaming. Slut-shaming in fantasy. A lot of this comes down to internalised misogyny, and it's noticeable. You get it from male writers, you also get it from female writers. And honestly, when you put unchallenged slut-shaming on the page, it's not okay, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's very particular in A Court of Silver Flames, because Nesta is processing her own issues by going out drinking and having sex. Honestly, I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with that. The way she's doing it is damaging for her, but I don't see why people are kind of like, oh, you're having sex with strangers. And it's like, you guys have been doing all this for like hundreds of thousands of years, so what is your issue?
Yes. It is also very noticeable the way that it's framed, because apparently it's okay for women to lust after men and to imagine things and to read these books, which you know, are full of sexy kind of things, and to then be very skilled when it comes to having sex with men.
But you're not actually supposed to do it. Again,
but you're not actually supposed to do it.
It's that sort of wasp morality again, isn't it? Sort of like, nice girls don't, but they think about it a lot, and they are very over-sexed creatures waiting for the right man. Mm. It's a weirdly medieval way of looking at things. That is quite absolutely. Literally what medieval people believed about women.
Yes. Absolutely. It's just... Yeah, it's quite painful, actually, to see it, because...
The thing is, Nesta doesn't come across as someone who would necessarily be either squeamish about sex or particularly interested unless she had a connection with someone.
Yeah, and that is the really interesting thing, is that obviously they frame it, the way they frame it is that the reason they're intervening is because Nesta isn't acting like herself. And I'm also kind of saying that, yes, Nesta isn't acting like herself at all. Because if there's one character who would be very much the, no, I'm not going to just have sex with random people, it would be Nesta. It would 100% be Nesta, and it would also be Elaine, though apparently you find out that Elaine has had sex with her fiancé way back when she was human. Now, one theory I used to have before A Court of Silver Flames came out, and when you did have that kind of hint, was that I thought perhaps the reason Nesta was going around sleeping with other people was because the mating bond had slipped into place with her and Cassian during book 3.
Yeah.
And that the reason she was then running around having sex with other people was because she was trying to reject the mating bond. Because she was trying to reject this fae side of her, which had just stripped away her control, and she was desperately trying to grab control back again. At which point the narrative sort of makes sense. It makes sense for her to go, fuck, I'm not going to do what you've... Sorry, I'm swearing a lot today. She's like, I'm not going to do what this cauldron has told me to do, because apparently the cauldron, or whatever, is the one who decides, you know, the mating bonds, where she said, I like Cassian, but actually, I'm not going to do what Destiny has told me to do because I don't like what Destiny has done to me. But this isn't the case. That isn't what's happened at all. They've just kind of had her sort of sleeping around. And it's very obvious that the behaviours that Nesta is exhibiting are meant to be all the behaviours that we kind of... The West, I say in inverted commas, looks down upon. So, you know, the whole, she's been drinking, she's been gambling, she's been sleeping around. She lives in a kind of like a shitty apartment, etc. You know, she doesn't wash properly, she doesn't change her sheets between the times that she has sex, etc. And you've got all these things and you just think, this, it doesn't make sense. None of it makes sense for her character, for the way that she's developed. And also, you can try and say, well, we're intervening because she's not behaving like herself, and say, absolutely fine. But then you can't then say, okay, but why is she not behaving like herself? and not provide an explanation for why she suddenly becomes Sex McGee and really, really wants to sleep around with loads of people, which again isn't an issue, particularly because we then find out that Cassian has a flashback about that time he screwed someone, you know, in the back alley behind a nightclub or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, and that's
and apparently that was fine.
I think, I mean, that is the thing. The female characters are not allowed to be at all demi or asexual, which is, yes, again, quite offensive. And Sarah J. Maas does not make any distinction between sex and intimacy. And there's nothing wrong with, by the way, if you're somebody who enjoys sex without the intimacy side of it, that's absolutely fine. Or if you enjoy, yeah, intimacy without sex, again, absolutely fine. But she treats it as if it's the same thing, which is why, yeah, Cassian and Nesta's relationship makes zero sense, because they have nothing in common other than the fact that they want to screw each other. And I don't, yes, even buy Nesta wanting to screw Cassian. I really don't. It makes it, you know, if she'd had a thing with Amron, I genuinely thought for a minute that maybe they'd had an affair and then sort of split up from the way that they were acting. And I was like, this would be very strange for Sarah J. Maas, because she does not write queer characters, but okay, maybe.
Yes.
So, yeah, none of that made any sense whatsoever. But at the same time, while you have to be this hyper-sex creature if you're a female character in a Maas novel, you also have to not be doing it. Or, you know, if you're female, you have to not be doing it. And if you're a male character, presumably you've had many, many, many lovers and you can't remember the names of most of them, which is said a few times. So,
yes,
yeah, it's all just really kind of embarrassing. By comparison, I'm going to talk about Cressley Cole's Immortals After Dark. Cressley Cole does hit some of these same tropes, but she does it in a way that does actually challenge whether or not they're right. Some of her books read as kind of rapey in places. And then you realise that you're not actually reading about a human substitute at all. You're reading about an immortal being acting in a certain way. Sometimes it's the men who've never had sex before. Sometimes it's, yeah, the women. Sometimes it's a case of, well, I've been alive for 600 years. Of course I've experimented with both genders, or with all genders kind of thing. It's a much more balanced view. She does actually have gay characters who form mating bonds as well, for example. And I can't help thinking that Maas has actually read Cole's work, taken what she likes, and then ignored some of the discussion that's gone around it.
Yes.
It reads like it to me.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. It's just, it's a complicated issue, and as you say, there are ways of addressing these things, and there are ways of also addressing the fact that there are people who do believe certain things and who can have internalised certain things. But you've got to think about also why you're writing it, and it's got to make sense. Things don't just happen. There's a line of cause and effect. And I really do feel that when it came to Nesta, Maas has even said that a lot of Nesta's kind of emotional journey was very much based on things that Maas herself had been dealing with emotionally. And I'm not going to lie, part of what helped me get through A Court of Silver Flames is that even if I didn't feel that it was right for Nesta as a character, her emotional journey resounded well with me, if I just ignored the character side of things. Which isn't a great way to read a book, but hey-ho. But the problem is that it didn't fit. It didn't fit with the character, it didn't fit with the world, it didn't fit with the entire structure altogether. And that was a big, you know, big problem, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, moving on to our next point, which is the caricaturisation of female sexual assault survivors, or the rape is the main character's backstory, or rape threat is used as characterisation, a shortcut for saying this is the bad guy. This is obviously another one of my jostling for top position of top bugbear. This is lazy writing. This is genuinely a lazy writing issue. And it is actually, I would say, while the others you could say, well, some people like reading it, this is actually something that is really harmful to put in a book and to keep perpetuating. I suppose this is a point I think I made when I reviewed A Court of Silver Flames, was the fact that Sarah J. Maas seems to have male characters who are either rapists or potential rapists, or, you know, the absolute best thing since sliced bread. And that's why she has such difficulty with Tamlin, because while Tamlin did fall into the emotionally abused trap because that's how he's processing his own trauma, he wasn't actually a rapist. And so she's having difficulty with giving him any sort of redemption arc. She genuinely doesn't know what to do with him. this is a real problem, and I seem to be getting this from, you know, everything I read at the moment. I read Alice Arden's Cities of the Dead, and the main character narrowly avoids being gang raped by two rival witches, male witches from a different coven. And then I think the problem is then it's not sort of processed as she's traumatized. She's literally only traumatized when it helps move the plot along from moving her away from the person that she has been going out with and shifting her towards, you know, the 500-year-old vampire that she really wants to sleep with, but has been telling herself that she doesn't want to sleep with, who has an attic full of tortured witches. Because apparently that's normal and that's fine, and we don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, totally fine.
Despite the fact that, you know, the witch boy is kind of her age, really loves her, really cares about her, and has just made a few little emotional cock-ups. So I'd like to go on record and say that I really, really like the Casket Girl series, in the sense of the world building is phenomenal. It really feels like you get all the layers of New Orleans. And the magic system and everything's really interesting. But I hate the main character now. I genuinely hate the main character. Not because she was almost sexually assaulted, but because that was all just used to completely castigate another character. I hate this tradition of making one male love interest the bad guy in order to have the female character have a guilt-free tryst with another one. Simply because it's okay for somebody to just not love someone else. It's okay for them to just fall out of love with someone else. It's okay for them to just go, you know what, I really care about you, but I'm sorry, I'm 16 and I'm really horny and I really, really like that other person. You know? I feel genuinely conflicted. I love both of you and you clearly don't want to form some sort of polyamorous relationship with me. So where do we go from here? I have to make a choice.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I realise I've stacked that in with sort of sexual assault and rape, but I think the problem is that it's another one of those things where you're denying female characters sexual agency, so they can't say, well, I like having sex with this person, but I really want to have sex with this person as well, and that doesn't make me a bad person for wanting it.
Yeah. I think, okay, so this is the way that I see it. Is it also comes in the fact that people in there are a lot of writers who still place sex and rape in the same category, where rape is a sexual act. It's not a sexual act. It's a violent act. It's an act of violence. And for the person who is on the receiving end of that, it's an act of violence. It's an act of violence in the same way that being tortured is an act of violence, that being beaten is an act of violence. It's just a different category, okay? It's different, but it's an act of violence. And what I particularly note is the way that they will often allow male characters to recover from similar acts of violence, and the way that they will then frame sexual acts of violent, and again I use the word sexual there, I don't like using the word rape, not because of the word, it just, yeah, anyway,
I think I know what you mean. Sexual assault is the only crime whereby you have two perpetrators and no victim until someone's convicted.
Yeah.
And it's that victim blaming that is a real issue.
It's not just that, it's also the recovery, the way that they frame recovery. In that, whenever you have a female character who has been sexually assaulted or who has been raped, they immediately all act in the same way. Now, it's really important to note that it's a horrific thing to happen to you, and it has happened to too many people, and the way that you react to that is no indication of your value as a person. So it could be something which completely emotionally destroys you, that destroys your confidence, that completely tears you down. That doesn't mean you're weak, that doesn't mean that, you know, that you take any responsibility for what happened to you. It's really important to say that. But what gets me is, in particular, is the way that you have male characters usually who are tortured and stuff like that, and who also receive acts of violence, who never get who we never see having that same reaction, that destruction of confidence, that feeling of horror or anything. You know, they never go through the same motions, which we almost always force on female characters. And when female characters are put through violence, we never see them getting tortured, we never see them, you know, being, you know, like waterboarded or anything like that. It's always sexual violence, it's always sexual assault, it's always rape. And that really gets me, because it's totally anti-feminist, because first of all, it just says, well, that wouldn't happen to men, the male character won't do it. Again links in this idea of rape being inherently sexual rather than act of humiliation and violence, and it also again puts this pressure on the idea of men just brushing it off and women becoming lesser because of it and then having to rebuild themselves up, which is not the case at all. There are some people who have survived sexual assault who will behave differently. They will react with anger. They will, it won't affect them in the same way. There are some men who've been tortured or things like that who will completely crumble, but we never see those nuanced narratives at all. We just see men get beaten up and tortured and walk it off and they're okay, with occasionally maybe you'll see them, maybe they have a few nightmares or stuff like that if we're really sort of dragging it along, like the way they did Tony Stark's PTSD in Marvel, which was again kind of looked down upon, and they didn't ever really discuss it. But women on the other hand have to have this whole story arc, and that's the only arc they're ever given, the recovery from rape.
Or it's particularly pernicious when it's part of the main character's backstory, and the reason that she will not form a romantic attachment is because it's part of her backstory. So if you want to take Red Sonja, for example, her backstory is that the soldiers of the Empire came down, destroyed her village, killed her entire family, and raped her and left her for dead. And then after that, she decided to learn to use a sword, etc., and go on a mission of vengeance. They could have left out the rape thing, because if you killed my entire family, I absolutely guarantee I'm coming for you. You know, you don't really need to go that one step further. So that was very much a kind of... That was, as you say, it was a sexual thing. It wasn't presented as an act of violence. And she, you know, she, after that, her big stance is that she will never have another man until he has beaten her in battle. So they really double down on that whole issue.
Yes.
So that's incredibly problematic.
It's the way that the rape is put above everything else, like the whole other traumas and stuff like that. Apparently this is the biggest one. And again, I should point out that there is something to be said about how truly violent sexual assault is, because it's something which people usually perceive with pleasure. No one usually perceives being waterboarded with pleasure. No one usually perceives, you know, being beaten with pleasure or anything like that. Usually, you know, an act of a sexual act is supposed to be pleasurable. It is a thing which is pleasurable, which is very natural, etc. So to have something like that and to then be raped is absolutely horrifying, and it can, for some people, they could say that is one of the worst things that could happen to somebody else, because it has deep, deep emotional, physical wounds that go along with it. But it's not the only thing, and you've got to stop using it as the only possible thing, the worst thing that could happen to a female character.
Yeah, the other issue is, as you say, the way people react to it. Some people react to it by not curling up in a little ball and dying. They react to it by repressing it and dealing with it 20 years later, or not dealing with it ever at all, or just being angry, as you say all the time, or becoming incredibly violent. Yeah. In fact, that's a very normal reaction, is to suddenly become a very violent person to anyone there who is perceived as a threat. So what I hated...
It's also... Sorry, I just also want to point out that there's one side to sexual abuse which people never want to talk about, which is that people who've been sexually abused can sometimes also then become hypersexual.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is a thing that happens. It is a thing that happens, and no one wants to talk about it. No one wants to depict it. They just kind of want to say, no, if you've been through that, you will never ever want to have that kind of, you don't want to be touched or anything like that. And no, the absolute opposite can happen, where people are trying to, in their heads, sort of rectify what's happened.
Yeah.
Or to actually make peace with it, because they think, well, a part of me even enjoyed, a part of me, there was some pleasant sensation when I was forced. But forgetting completely the fact that the body is supposed to feel pleasure in that way, which means that just because you gained some pleasure from it doesn't mean that you wanted it, or that you deserved it to happen. But that is a narrative that does actually happen in real life, and no one wants to talk about it in fiction.
No, absolutely. And again, it's a very natural way of then trying to reassert control. You kind of become a predator in your own right without the pausing.
Yes.
So yeah, that's a perfectly normal thing. So yeah, that's all a bit of an issue. And I think Sarah J. Maas was going for a full house on her bingo card of shit things to put in there, because she had all these sexually abused priestesses and things who were given a place to be, a safe space, which is underground in a library. And on the surface, that sounds great, but some of them have been there for hundreds of years and no one's really offering them any alternative until Nesta comes along. And I would also like to point out that the alternative to having been sexually assaulted or recovering from that sort of trauma is not always to become a warrior, despite what Red Sonja Sal tells us. I'm a big advocate for everyone learning how to defend themselves. And certainly if something like that has ever happened to you, then learning how to defend yourself can be an important step on the road to recovery.
Yes.
On the other hand, I wouldn't then say, you know what, I think you should really train up and go for the Karate World Championships, because that might not be you, okay? And self-defense is completely different to learning to actively fight. Self-defense is for the moment. It's not for going out and getting into fights and, you know, in Court of Silver Flames terms, killing off a bunch of people in the Blood Rite kind of thing. It's another one of those things that just didn't make sense and it had been badly thought out. I also hate the fact that our token bad guys in that book were by default rapey characters. I mean, they could have just been really unpleasant. They could have just been sexist. They could have just been sort of looking down on female characters as being inept baby makers. You know, they didn't have to be sort of like, oh, well, in that case, I will rape you kind of thing. You don't have to be... That doesn't have to be your go-to.
Yeah. It's also important to recognise that even bad people, even shitty people, don't want to go around raping other people all the time.
No. And I kind of get that the whole Illyrian thing is a very thinly disguised metaphor for certain, shall we say, Middle Eastern cultures, whereby the mindset is that an unattended woman is kind of candy. I get that that's in there, along with the whole sort of the wing clipping is stand-in for female genital mutilation.
Yeah, but it's also very much based on a Western view of how certain cultures see women. Yes, there is a reality to it in certain places, but it's incredibly... You can see so badly that it's entirely through a Western gaze.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's badly done in that respect. Okay, moving on, because we could do an entire episode on that, but we won't. Not at the moment. Gaslighting and coercion presented as choice without them being challenged on the page.
Oh my god! Okay. Sorry. I'm so angry.
Does this one rang Madeline's bell?
Oh my god. Yes, okay. All right, so I'm so sorry to be shitting all over Sarah J. Maas, because like I said, I really did enjoy this book, but at the same time, there's this whole thing which is, it's got to be your choice. It's always got to be your choice. And here's the thing, right? Okay. Once again, cast our minds back to A Court of Thorns and Roses, yes, where Tamlin trapped Feyre in the house with a force field, right? A force field which, once she was trained up and stuff like that, she could have probably broken. Once she was trained up, she could have winnowed out of there, okay? She just didn't have the skills to do it at that time. She was trapped in this force field, having gone through something traumatic, and obviously she reacted badly. And this is seen as the pinnacle of abuse. You know, this is the thing that's always, they always come back to, and how he abused her, is that he trapped her in that house. And again, he trapped her from the point of, he was entirely traumatized. Again, not saying it was right, but you understand why he did it. Fast forward now to Nesta. They say, right, we're not only going to say you've got to do these things that we're telling you to do, we are going to demolish your home, the one that you live in. We're going to sort of take away all of your credit and basically say, here's your choice. You can either do what we want, or we're going to send you to the human world where you have literally nothing and no one, and all the people will hate you there and may attempt to kill you. That's not a choice. That's not a choice. That is a threat. That's coercion. That's okay. That's like saying, you either do what I tell you to do in this household, or I'll throw you out onto the streets. Okay? If anyone said that to a child, or to anyone said that to a dependent, that would be considered abuse. Okay? That would be considered abuse. Particularly someone who was going through massive trauma at the time, even if they are 25, someone who was going through massive trauma at the time, whose only choice was, you are going to do exactly what I say, or you are going to be thrown out, not just even thrown out into the sort of the general world, put into a place where people will physically try to do you harm. That's not a choice. So then what they do is they then go, right, we're going to put you in the House of Wind. And they say, your choice is, you can actually leave, but you don't physically have the capability to leave.
Yeah.
In order to leave, she has to go down these 1,000 steps.
10,000.
Sorry, 10,000 steps. My apologies. She has to go down 10,000 steps. And it's acknowledged, they acknowledge the fact that she is not physically capable of going down those steps. So once again, we're in a position where a female has been trapped in a house that she is not in the physical, she is not in a physical condition to be able to escape. And somehow that's seen as care, rather than Tamlin saying, I'm keeping you here because you don't know how to use your powers and people are probably trying to kill you, and also I have real massive control issues. Again, not a right thing, but there was a reason behind it. This is just because they were genuinely just a bit embarrassed with Nesta. Instead of them saying, okay, what we're going to ask you to do is, we're going to cut you off, we're going to cut off the amount of money that you can spend, we're going to encourage you to get a job and send you to a counsellor, which apparently they have.
Yeah.
They have counsellors, but at no point do they think, maybe let's send Nesta to a counsellor. No, no, no. They just trap her in a house and say, the only way that you can get better is forced labour and to become, and to train.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just bollocks. And there's all sorts of those little bits of coercion. And it's like, they're never, ever going to really make me swallow Rhysand as a decent, this super feminist lord of the Night Court. Because all, yeah, I can remember is him drugging Feyre and effectively sexually assaulting her for her own good, to keep her safe,
yeah,
in the first book. And it's just, the more you think about it, the more uncomfortable it is. And all that stuff about the pregnancy that we've already talked about just echoes back to it, sort of that, okay, anything that someone says, this is for your own good, unless you are literally a child, and possibly even then, you should be giving them some serious side eye.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's a real issue for me. And, you know, this is obviously not the only book it happens in. Again, not having a poke at paranormal romance, but you get it with the sort of the overbearing male love interest, sort of like, I'm not going to let you do this because sometimes it's overprotectiveness, sometimes it's just possessiveness. And I get that there is a core audience that just sort of laps that up because they like the idea of an overbearing male sort of taking control for a bit. This is not what we're talking about in fantasy. This happens a lot in fantasy and it is not okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. This is a very short point, but male children are presented as a more desirable choice. So you have a pregnant female character, you've gone through the entire rigmarole of having a female character and the whole it's a boy thing. It's like, why? Why is that still a thing?
Yes.
Again, really pisses me off.
See, what would have been really interesting is if they had actually given birth to a daughter who was going to be the actual High Lady of the Night
Court. Yes, who became the heir.
When Rhysand died, became the actual heir of, you know, became the High Lady. But no, she hasn't done that. But that being said, it doesn't always go to the eldest, so...
It doesn't, but I mean, it's just kind of... It's Feyre's obvious sort of like, it's a boy, I'm so happy it's a boy. I'm like, why? Why does the gender matter?
Yeah.
At that point. Because she'd never even wanted to really be pregnant before. So this all happens in a very small amount of time. Anyway, the alpha male love interest fiasco. We've kind of covered a lot of this in previous episodes, and we've covered it certainly with some of the coercion and gaslighting and stuff. I think the more I read a male, an alpha male love interest, I find them very two-dimensional characters. As in, they literally just turn up to look really, really hot with their shirts off and sort of impinge the free-spirited, not like the other girls, independent female character who will undoubtedly discover she has a softer side. And it's just, I'm so, so tired of it.
I really am. I also want to point out that whenever, and again, I'm sorry, but I'm picking on the God of Thorns and Roses series, whenever they're shirtless, it talks about all of their muscles and stuff like that. And I'm like, the muscles you are describing are the muscles of bodybuilders, which are done in a very specific way that you're also dehydrated in a very specific way in order to show them off. It's the same what you see on superheroes and stuff like that. They dehydrate themselves for those shots. They work out in very particular ways in order to kind of make it look like that. It's an entirely aesthetic thing. It is not actually an indication of how physically strong or capable they are, which is why when you see a lot of the trainers and stuff like that who were training them how to do the sword stuff and things like that, they don't have the same kind of rippling muscles. They don't have the same kind of structure of the body. They tend to also be a little bit larger as well. That's actually what people who genuinely are warriors or genuinely are fighting look like. It's not the aesthetic thing.
No, absolutely. And it is just, again, it can't just be me going, yeah, okay, but where's his personality? As in, the pectorals are very much a secondary consideration.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's all clearly wasted on me. It's like, have you got a brain? Can you string a sentence together? No, I'm clearly going to get bored with you. I'm probably not going to even enjoy one roll in the hay with you because you've clearly got no conversation and no imagination.
Yeah.
So, but no, taking it aside from me, and taking it aside from the whole paranormal romance genre, because the whole point of that is that it's a fantasy figure for a romantic purpose. Don't sell something to me as an actual fantasy novel and then present me with that crap. Because we can do better. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, that goes for when you have roles that are divided by gender and explained to be biological differences.
Yes.
Put it this way. This is really simple. If you have a type of magic or something and only one gender can do it, then it's already sexist. Mm-hmm. Now, you might have a reason for that. For example, you can have Frank Herbert's Bene Gesserit in Dune. They're still sexist. They're a group of female eugenicists who are basically playing the power behind the throne. There's very good reasons for what they do. No one's pretending that they're egalitarian in any way. It is, however, slightly more of an issue when it's a case of the male feels the mating bond and the female must accept it or not, and she accepts it by presenting him with food. And I'm like, can you not see that? You know, you can't then turn around and say it's a biological imperative, because that's really bad. If you've got something that is a sentient species, then it doesn't matter what the biological imperative is. You can still think around it.
Life is difficult.
that's an ice cream headache right there. We've talked about the strong female character before and how she always seems to have a sword. Now, I'm a big fan of swords, but there are many ways to be strong. And I get annoyed when a female character can only be presented as strong when she embraces actions and roles that are typically seen as, or stereotypically seen as, being male. So taking on masculine attributes or things that are supposed to be masculine attributes. It's like Madeline said earlier, why don't we have a man who's really into embroidery or something? Because it's not actually that unusual. Why don't we have a female character who happens to be a really good seamstress, but, you know, can defend herself? Or, you know, with Nesta, who literally sort of becomes a quasi-goddess of death, why did she learn to use a sword and be a warrior when she could have just been a really shrewd political player? She could have been possibly the best political player on the board.
Yeah.
Because that was something she was already really good at.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's this narrowing down of the qualities that we say make someone capable.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Physical descriptions. We've taken
breasts. Sorry.
Exactly.
The only thing that matters. The only thing that
matters. Breasts. What they look like. And you know, lately it's been what mood those breasts are in, because apparently they're independent sentient orbs just attached to a female body, according to many, many male writers out there. This is something we've touched on before. Basically, whether you're a female writer or a male writer, and I am disgusted by the number of female writers who've taken to doing this, if you're discussing a character breasts first, then you've got problems, in the sense of your characterization is probably really shit.
Yeah, you need to, and again, this can be something that's internalized. Ask yourself, why are the breasts important? There might be a reason why at some point the breasts are important, but are they the most important thing at any given time?
And that's not to say, obviously, that women do not notice these things about each other. They do, particularly if they happen to really like breasts, you know? I'm not going to say it's not something that strikes me, because it absolutely is, but I'm more likely to notice someone's eye colour before going down, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not going to be part of this group of people who are saying, oh, well, you can't discuss them at all. You can't discuss anything below the neck. And even then, it's a bit dicey. Because, you know, it absolutely can be, if you're having a physical description in your books, it absolutely can be something that should be there. But at the same time, it's really weird. It's sort of in the Throne of Glass series. Selena's kind of comparing her breasts with every other woman, and, you know, there's breast envy going on, and it's all very weird. It's like this entire subplot about boobs. So,
yeah.
If you are a female writer who is writing women's bodies like you are, in fact, a man, you might want to look at that, is what I'm saying.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I think that kind of ties in also with sort of black and white thinking in terms of character arcs.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's definitely a bigger subject.
Bigger.
It's a much bigger subject. Bigger. I was doing the Malaysian version of qualifying something. A much bigger subject in possibly something we should look at in more detail. But just in short, if you've only got good characters and bad characters, then I would suggest you probably haven't got great characterization, because no one is just good or bad. So even with your absolute villain, there should be some point of redeeming quality there. And even with your best hero, there should be something that makes people go, oh, that's not so great. And it shouldn't be something like clumsiness either, ideally. It should be an actual character flaw.
Yeah. Okay, so also, all right, I've got to mention this one. Sexist slurs.
Yeah. I think if they're your go-to place, then you probably need to have a bit of a think about why that is. On the other hand, you can pry the word bitch out of my cold, dead hands, because I will use that regardless of gender. If I think you've got that one coming, I will use it. So, you know, no one really has the right to police exactly what someone else says, particularly if it's a word that belongs to everybody kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the other hand, if that's your go-to every single time, that's not great and says a lot more about you than it does about whoever's reading it.
It is also worth noting that you can have sexist characters and stuff like that who use sexist slurs and stuff like that. We're not saying you can't use those things at all, that you can't have sexist or unpleasant characters. It's all about the way that you frame things. It's all about the way that you put them forward. And you can also have characters who have internalized those things. But then that should be part of their character.
Yeah, I mean, okay, this is an Avengers thing, but in the first, Avengers Assemble, when you've got Loki has been imprisoned and you've got Black Widow going to speak to him, he calls her a mewling quim. And I've never seen anybody say, Loki's kind of a sexist git, isn't he? Like, well, obviously he is. Is it that people don't understand that quim is another word for cunt? That it's literally the word for cunt?
I did not know
that. Oh, is that? Okay, so this is a word thing, and that's why people are not calling Loki out for being a chauvinist pig on that. Right,
no,
okay.
I did not know that.
Yes, that's what a quib is. A sing with a cunny. If someone calls you that, then that's literally what they're saying. I don't necessarily have a problem with I'm not immediately offended by the word in the way some people are, but at the same time, let's acknowledge that it's applied to women more often than it's applied to men, and therefore, unless you're in Scotland, in which case, you know, you might call your best friend a cunt. Yes. The Scots are very strange. said with all love and being, you know, part Scottish. But yeah, it's just, I think it's everybody, somewhat, I think the director wanted a suitably aggressive word that carried that connotation, but wasn't going to immediately get called out, and obviously couldn't actually use the C word itself. But yes. Would he have called Iron Man a mewling quim? I think not.
It's also strange because the one person that Loki respected in the entire world was his mother.
Yep.
And also, since Loki does even in the Marvel canon, but not necessarily in the MCU, Loki does spend a certain amount of time, you know, as a woman. So it's a bit strange.
Yeah,
really?
It's like Loki is like, well, what gender are you today? Well, I don't know. could be either. Could be any.
I'm all genders today.
That is the entire point of that character. So, yeah. The other thing that I've seen presented in fantasy as being feminist, although admittedly not recently, is women as property. This was a David Eddings thing in his Belgariad series, whereby arguably the most powerful female character and possibly the most competent character of all, Polgara, who is a sorceress, spends, I don't know, 10, 15 years technically being owned by a man, and not in a sexual way, just in the case of if you're a woman in that culture, you have to be owned by a man. That's how you're protected. Yeah. And you actually wear an anklet and a chain kind of thing, which is getting into dicey bondage territory, in my opinion.
Yes.
There's all these male writers who kind of like, they've clearly got a bit of a bondage thing that they want to try out, but they're too shy to really talk about it, so it goes in the books.
Yeah. That's uncomfortable.
Oh, honestly, I think that was the thing with Terry Goodkind. I also think it was a bit of a thing with Jim Butcher at one point. But yeah, and the way she's talking about it when her sort of foster son, Gary, and is saying, well, that's dreadful. You were a slave, Aunt Polgara. You can't possibly, you know, this is a terrible culture. And she's saying, well, no, women were accorded the greatest respect. And, you know, when I was then, I arranged to be sold on. I then drove up my own price to show how valuable it was. And I'm like, I don't care how you slice it. That's really, really not a feminist stance to take.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. All right. I think in conclusion, ultimately, there are a million different ways to be a girl, there are a million different ways to be a boy, there are a million different ways to be a person.
Definitely. And paying too much attention to the little boxes is definitely hobbling all of us. We can do better in science fiction and fantasy, in my opinion. You can have the things that we've talked about in the last two episodes in your books and your stories. But they should be there because they're a deliberate choice, because you've thought them through. They shouldn't just be there because that's what you think is normal, necessarily. So if you find little things that we've been talking about creeping in, maybe have a little think about why they're there.
Yeah, definitely. And as I said, you can internalise these things. And it's not that you're not allowed to have these things. But again, make sure there's a reason. There's got to be a reason there. And if you don't know that reason, maybe look inside of yourself a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. We've all got a duty, for lack of a better word, to question our internalised biases and things. Not doing it is lazy. And not doing it with your writing is very lazy.
Yeah. Also, here's another thing. If you write something and then years down the line you look back at it and you go, oh god, that's actually quite sexist or stuff like that, weirdly enough, that's a good thing.
Yeah, you've moved on. That's okay.
You've moved on, but also society has moved on. That's the direction we should be going in. So it's okay if you have written sexist things, and it's okay if you write things which will one day become sexist. That's fine. You're allowed, and you also are allowed to make mistakes. You're okay, but just going forward, think about it. Think about why you're making certain decisions. Think about why you're using certain words. Does it fit with the character? Does their character fit? And, you know, maybe the reason you're doing it is just that you say, I like this trope. And if that's the case, fine. Go for it. But examine why.
Definitely. Final thought, as we've said at the very beginning of the first part of this series, we're not doing a series of episodes, the first part of part one of this topic, feminist does not mean exclusionary.
No.
So it is for everyone. And, you know, if you don't want to use the word feminist, that's also fine. As long as we're talking about the same sort of collection of ideologies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Right. So we should probably wrap it up there, I think, because we've still managed to go over despite it being a two-parter.
We had a lot to unpack and a lot to get angry about. Yes. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe that you have got one for us.
Yes, most unusually, I am recommending an album this week. I recently discovered David Gray's new album, Skellig, on Spotify, and it's fairly recently released. I've only listened to a little bit of David Gray's work before, but this one somehow really hit home. And I think, you know, Skellig, obviously the title song, is based on the children's book about the angel. And it just really, really fits. And then you follow the album through, and it's like the entire thing is telling you a story about bits and pieces of someone's childhood all the way through. It's been really, really great to write to, actually. So I highly recommend that one.
That sounds really interesting. Thanks very much. Definitely have to check that out. Putting it on my Spotify right now. So, guys, thanks very much for listening. Do get in touch with us. What do you think? Do you have anything to add? Do you think we've missed out on any tropes? Do you disagree with us? We'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can get in touch with us via our Facebook, our Twitter, or our Tumblr, both individually and as Dissecting Dragons. We look forward to hearing from you, and for now, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.